From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
This morning we speak first with local resident Sophia Maletti, who talks about sound as medicine. She trains mental health practitioners to use sound healing. She practices both locally and in a new retreat center in Guatemala.
Then, someone who's commuted 100,000 miles on a bike in Los Angeles, Peter Flax, who shares all things bike-related in Live to Ride, finding joy and meaning on a bicycle.
These guests, when we return, you're listening to The Mountain Life here on KPCW. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
Now, we've all experienced the healing properties of sound, whether it's a song that transports us to a memory, comforts us, or evokes our emotion. But today, we're going to talk about using sound as a specific protocol for healing. We welcome local resident Sophia Maletti, who grew up in Park City and now, as a professional, engages in many modalities surrounding mental and physical well-being. She joins us today to introduce a new retreat center that she has founded in Lake Atitlan, Guatemala, and also to discuss sound as medicine and the training that she gives to present sound healing to other health professionals. Sophia Maletti, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thanks, Lynn. Thanks, Mary Beth.
It's always great to have you on the show. You present some of these protocols and these practices in a way that is very articulate. So I'm just going to start off by asking, what is sound healing?
Well, I kind of stumbled across it. A client of mine, Diana Swanner, presented me with a gift. One day I came to her house I was working with her doing foundation training. And she said, I got you this singing bowl. And it was just one of the most thoughtful gifts anybody has ever given me. And I grew up in a musical family. I play the piano. Especially my mom and dad, I've always been around music, but the sound bowls and using sound as medicine it wasn't something I really knew much about until she presented me with this bowl. And I started playing it and I could feel something in my own body, and just like my heart rate, my breathing slowed. I could feel it when I just play it for myself. And then I bought another one, and then I bought another one, and then I started buying more sound healing instruments and just sort of playing these sound baths at home and for friends. And then the studio where I work here in town, Enlighten, one of the teachers left to move to Hawaii, and she asked me if I would take over her yoga class that had a sound healing at the end. And I said, of course, I would love to. And so I was just kind of presented to this world, and in a very organic way. What I noticed is that there was an impact. I didn't have an expectation of what was going to happen. And then all of a sudden I had people coming up to me after class saying that I was changing their lives, and that the sound journey that they got to lie in every week was what they look forward to most. And then I started this Healing Sounds series with Mountain Town Music and Wild Woman Tribe. And we started doing these community sound healings, and it's changed my life as a practitioner, just knowing that thing as simple as just lying down and enjoying music and sound can make such a big impact on someone's mental health and also your physiology too.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of physiology, what is happening actually in your body when you're having this vibration from the sound, and particularly from these singing bowls?
So your breathing slows, your heart slows, heart rate variability actually increases. So when your heart rate variability goes up and increases, your autonomic nervous system is basically balancing. your brain waves are actually elongating and slowing, going from beta to theta. And which is when you're in a theta state, it's kind of the state your brain waves are kind of in between sleep and awake. And it's the long wave brain wave that is associated with downloading memories, basically kind of hitting the save button on memories. So it's if you don't fall asleep, it's very similar to the impact that non-sleep deep rest has on our brains. Yoga nidra has a similar impact on your brain. So all kinds of things are happening. So I mean, we could talk about this for 2 hours. Your parasympathetic nervous system charges and turns on. So just the state of resting, your body is primed for healing, right? And if none of this is occurring, we know that at the very least, you're in a state of deep rest and relaxation.
Which is a wonderful place to be, right?
Of course, yeah. Who doesn't?
So those are some of the terrific physical benefits. When people came up to you and said things like these practices are changing their lives, what kind of experiences were they having?
So we do a lot of the longer sound baths that we do. We actually allow for 20 to 30 minutes of integration where we can actually sit and share and talk about what's come up during the sound healing. And I've heard so many things, just the sense of clearing energy, stuck energy, moving energy. I've had people that they've had grief that they've been carrying for years that has moved through them. One really interesting share that we had after sound bath was a woman who said she had had IVF earlier that week, and she felt a little flutter, like she, like the
life force,
the egg was attaching. We hear stories of people having visitations from loved ones who have passed on, lots of clearing energy in the throat, around the throat and heart chakras. And yeah, that's one of the reasons we really like to have the integration at the end of the experience, so that what ends up happening is someone will say, something happened to me, and it seems like, you know, they'll kind of go into detail about something that seems kind of strange. And then someone else will chime in and say, I had that same experience, you know? So all kinds of things happen when, you know, in these sound journeys. Even if you don't move energy, even if you don't have, you know, a download or an epiphany or some sort of a healing experience, it's deeply relaxing.
What do you find is the difference between the experience of maybe doing it for yourself or just in a kind of a meditative thing and then doing it in a group? That integration part seems like an important piece, but are there other elements?
I think for me, that's the biggest part, is creating a container, a space where people can share and kind of bounce these experiences off one another and feel heard and witnessed. I would say that's the main difference. I have done sound healings with one or two people in kind of smaller containers. You know, it could be more intimate. I've done it for couples before. So
should this be the new thing that we do for therapy or marriage counseling? Have started with a sound bath.
I mean, it's it's one of those tools. Like I always, you know, my approach is that why not take advantage of all the tools that we have, especially if they're as simple and easy as just, you know, moving your body, going for a walk, using your breath as a wellness tool, using instruments that you have around the house. Even you don't need to have expensive crystal bowls. Lying down next to a piano or a guitar for me and closing my eyes is going to have a similar impact on my body and my nervous system as the bowls. The event that I just did last weekend, I've been working with a really talented sound practitioner. His name is Justin Cromer, and he has a sound healing company called Maloka Sound. He's really talented. I found him when I was doing the Healing Sound series for Mountain Town Music. And so now we've done like 4 sound healings together. And last weekend we probably had 70 instruments that we were using. So the bowls are a big part of it, but you know, it depends on the practitioner and what kind of instruments they have and they're skilled at. And the thing is that what's happening in your body is your body becomes a musical instrument and is matching the frequencies that are occurring in the outside environment. So your body basically tunes to those frequencies and is playing those frequencies from the inside out, right? So a bowl or a guitar or a piano or a drum, your body's going to match those frequencies no matter what the instrument is, right?
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're speaking with local resident Sophia Maletti, and she's talking about sound healing. She is talking about, well, she's going to be splitting her time between Summit County and Guatemala, Lake Atitlan, at a little place that she is starting called Villas del Carmen. And I don't know all the history of your family, but I mean, most people know your family from the restaurant Maletti's that has been gone for quite some time now, but also your parents. And is it your mom who's Carmen, right? So the Villas del Carmen, and do you have a history in Guatemala? I think you do.
Yeah. So I named it that. It was a tribute to her. And, you know, the Carmen, the etymology of the word is, it's an Arabic word that means garden or orchard. Mm-hmm. And the property is, it's just beautiful. It's a secret garden in and of itself. So I named it that in tribute to her. Right now I have 3 retreats that are confirmed and hoping to book more. Not all the retreats that we do there will be my retreats. So I'm opening the property to any retreat facilitators around the world who want to come and teach any wellness modality, right? So anything from sound healing to breath work, men's groups, women's groups, everything, all of the above, right? And just starting. I mean, I guess it's been about 6 months in the making. The first retreat isn't booked until November, next November. So right now the business is operating as an Airbnb. The first retreat is November 4th through 11th, and that's with Stephanie Barton. So she and I will be doing a women's retreat, and we're calling it the Mountain Mermaid Retreat, bringing back the Mountain Mermaid theme. So that will be kind of like a pamper wellness goddess party with lots of healing and wellness modalities focused on women's health and a lot of play. So that one's going to be playful girl time. The other one is called the Soul Elements Retreat, and it's January 8th through 14th. And I'm doing that with Amanda Boyven Hill. And she is a human design practitioner. So she's going to teach us about human design and how to apply that in our lives to move through life, making better decisions because we know more about ourselves through human design. It's really interesting. I'm very excited about that. And then the other one is the Sound as Medicine Retreat. And that one is February 26th through March 5th. That retreat is, the offering is for mental health practitioners and anyone working in the mental health space, or any light worker really who wants to use sound as a form of medicine in their protocols as an adjunct to their offering. And so we have the analog sound healing that we'll be teaching, kind of presenting the instruments and showing the practitioners how to layer instruments through a sound healing, basically an intro to sound healing using kind of the analog version in the instruments. We'll have bowls and gongs and chimes and rattles and guitars and all of the analog instruments. And then the other half of that retreat is going to be with my friend Leo Canetto, who has a company called Zendo Stereo, and he specializes in crafting digital sound journeys.
This property was in, did belong to your family, or you have purchased it for this idea?
So this property is my mom's property. It's the same property where I had a restaurant. I opened a restaurant there in 2007, and it was open for 13 years, and that restaurant died of COVID, basically, like so many other restaurants. And so this is an effort to kind of rebrand the property and revitalize the business. We're not reopening a restaurant. We have kind of changed the business format, and it's a new business license. Yeah, just a kind of starting a new chapter.
If people are interested in signing up, and I hope they are, where should they look for more information?
So you could email me, and my email is Sophia, S-O-F-I-A, at sophiamiletti.com, S-O-F-I-A-M-I-L-E-T-I.com. And then we also have an Instagram, which is Villas, V-I-L-L-A-S, underscore Carmen, C-A-R-M-E-N, underscore Atitlan, A-T-I-T-L-A-N. So you can also just search V-S Del Carmen on Instagram.
You can put those in our description of the show if you'd like to come to kpcw.org and look up this show also.
Yeah, that'd be great. So you can find us on Instagram, and all the announcements, all the save the dates, all the information for all the retreats, basically everything you want to know about the retreat center is on Instagram. And then we're in the process of building a website right now.
Sure. Could you share a little bit about the a little bit more of the sign up information and stuff about the work you're doing at Enlighten?
Oh, sure. So there's an event there on the 8th of June. It's a Saturday from 6 to 8 p.m. And it's a new moon movement and sound healing workshop. So it's a 2-hour workshop. We'll be doing about 45 to 50 minutes of movement. And I call it movement because my background is in yoga, but I also teach foundation training, all these other movement modalities. So it's a yoga practice, but there's also other stuff sprinkled in there. And then we'll be doing about a 50-minute sound healing with an integration at the end as well. So Enlighten Wellness, it's in Prospector. And you can go to the website enlightenwellness.com or just search Enlighten Wellness, and there's a registration button there to sign up. It's $35 for the class. I'm also teaching there Sunday the 2nd. I have a class at the shop as well, Sunday the 2nd. So if you look at the shop website, you'll see my classes on there, and also at enlightenwellness.com, you'll see my classes on there as well.
Sophia, you have been you're a restaurant owner, but you have been into nutrition for a long time as well. Can you talk a little bit about that world? Because I believe at your retreat at Lake Atitlan, you also will have a restaurant in the hotel.
Yeah. So I also cook all the food at these retreats. I'm in the process of training staff down there, so that I can kind of pass that torch along. They're all my recipes. It depends on the group and the kind of the goals of the retreat and the participants. But for me, sourcing is more important than any kind of rigidity around diet. And so we're not doing vegan, we're not doing vegetarian, we're not doing carnivore, we're not doing paleo. My approach isn't rigid around the diet per se. It is rigid around sourcing and ingredients.
Mm.
And so believe it or not, Guatemala actually has amazing grass-fed beef, and that's basically due to a lack of industrialized farming, right? So we're just kind of producing meat in Guatemala the way we used to in the States 50 years ago. So all the meat is grass-fed, so that's really nice. There's a lot of really great organic food, vegetables, lettuces, herbs. And then every once in a while, I have to drive 2 4 hours to Guatemala City to find other stuff that is important to me, like grass-fed butter, etc. That's what I've kind of where I've arrived over the years is trying to stay away from the dogma around diets or types of diets or approaches of ways to eat, and just reminding myself and reminding my clients that the nourishment is coming from the food and the soil, you know, where it's grown, and the way the animals were cared for. We have an amazing egg project in the village where I live. So we always have fresh, farm fresh eggs there. I would really like to work to bring goats into the village so that we always have goat cheese and fresh goat milk. So yeah, so I think it's more about sourcing than anything else.
Well, I just wanted to mention that I actually am a certified sound healer too. A couple of years ago, I had an experience at a meditation group where I just became enamored with the sound of sound bowls, and I got kind of obsessed with them. And so I'm not a person who does it in order to practice on other people, but I'm infusing it into my musical recordings because I feel like that there's a lot of intention that you can kind of embed into recordings. And I just wanted to share what a fan I am of the whole process. I think it's an amazing thing and it's very subtle and profound. And I really would recommend if people are listening that they go and experience this if they haven't. It is so deeply affecting. It's just really a great experience. And I'm so happy you're bringing it to Park City and giving people the opportunity to go to Guatemala for it too.
Yeah, me too. It is really exciting. I'd love to see a handful of locals show up for the event on Saturday. So it's
Yeah.
just been such a gift for me. All of the things I've done in my life have required a lot of like efforting and kind of like this yang energy. Just work, 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 do, 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 do. And this has been the most organic and soft and feminine career path I've ever chosen. And
Wonderful.
it's not that I don't work at it. It just has kind of unfolded in the softest, gentlest, most organic way.
Well, that's beautiful. Sophia Maletti is our guest, and she's been talking to us today about sound baths, sound healing, sound bowls, and her new retreat center in Lake Atitlan, Guatemala, called Villas del Carmen, and also what she's doing coming up in Park City at Enlighten
Can I
on.
just one real quick reminder plug for the community too? We still have this really amazing series called Healing Sounds with Mountain Town Music that both Renee, Brian, and I, the three of us, worked really hard on it. And when I left, it didn't go away. We're still doing this monthly. So check out the Healing Sounds page on mountaintownmusic.org because those events are amazing.
Thanks. All
Yeah.
right. Thanks, Sophia. Thanks for joining us on The Mountain Life.
Thank you, ladies. I appreciate you.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
Our next guest, Peter Flax, has commuted on his bicycle nearly 100,000 miles in the last 10 years. In Los Angeles, you know, the city made up of highways where people never get out of their cars, right? Well, Peter says wrong. Peter is a Los Angeles-based writer and editor who has covered sports, adventure, and culture, and was the editor-in-chief of Bicycling Magazine. Peter writes about bike culture with a focus on advocacy, racing, and the beauty of the lifestyle around riding a bike. And whether you've caught the biking bug or generally don't get it, why this biking thing is so popular, stay tuned. Peter joins us now to discuss his new book, Live to Ride: Finding Joy and Meaning on a Bicycle. Peter, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thanks. Great to be here, and I appreciate the great intro.
Well, we're happy to have you. And we think, you know, here in Park City, it might be sort of a funny thing to invite a guy on who wrote a book about biking because, you know, a lot of the population here is really into biking, and even more so since the onset of the whole e-biking craze. A lot of people are on their bikes, but also a lot of people don't get it, I think. And it just leads me to the question to say, you know, biking's been a huge part of your life, and why do you think that is?
Well, I think that, you know, riding is one of those things that maybe like yoga or gardening, where you start out with like simple goals. And once you really get into it, you realize that it's like this full lifestyle that's more meaningful and broad than you thought it could be. For me, riding is fitness, it's how I get to work and to the store, it's how I unplug from my insane digital life. It's how I avoid going to the gas station. You know, it's how I think of a lot of my best ideas. And I recognize that not everyone feels that way, and that's okay too. It's like it's a beautiful lifestyle if you're into it. And so the book is like a celebration of the reasons why people love to ride.
Yeah, that's great. You know, I have found recently that oftentimes biking in a city is almost easier because there's better bicycle infrastructure. And I was, however, quite surprised that you have ridden 100,000 miles really in Los
Yeah.
Angeles. I always think of like people refer to where they live in Los Angeles by the highway that they live closest to. And so, talk about that kind of infrastructure in both Los Angeles and in cities in general.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say in general, I travel a lot for work, and every time I go to a North American city, I go like, oh, it's a little better than the last time I was here. Like it's trending in the right direction everywhere. I think LA maybe is like a half a step behind much of North America. Where I live and where I work is pretty straightforward for commuting, but LA can be pretty rugged. There are so many of these like broad arterial boulevards where everyone drives like highway speed if there's not traffic. And there often is traffic, and everyone's grumpy when they're driving. So for me, it works for my life. The weather is like incredible nearly all year. I ride along the Pacific Ocean for part of my commute. And so for me, it's way better than being stuck in traffic for an hour to get to the office. And like I said, it doesn't have to be for everyone. I like to evangelize about riding, but if somebody, it doesn't seem like the solution for them, then I'm never trying to convince people that they need to fall in love with the thing I'm in love with. I think it's a beautiful activity, but not for everybody.
I noticed that just the idea of commuting on a bike is so great. It's so good for the environment. It's good for you. But there are some practical concerns. You know, people who work in certain kinds of environments, maybe they're a little more dressed up and transporting stuff. How have you found workarounds to some of those questions?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I have like a privilege in the sense that, you know, my office has showers and lockers. And I have like this giant locker in my office with just like every clothing imaginable, where it's like if I walk in and somebody like throws out a weird client dinner that I wasn't expecting, I have a blazer in there. And so I try and be prepared. And a lot of people now are using e-bikes, which enable you to just wear regular clothes and even in pretty warm weather, just get right off the bicycle and go to a meeting if you had to. But if you're, you know, a medical salesperson who your whole job is like going to different hospitals to make calls, or your office is 50 miles from where you live, then it's not going to be the lifestyle for you. So I think that but part of it for me is all that improvisation becomes like a positive, where I like our lives can be so homogenized, where it's like just the adventure of dealing with it is part of the fun of it, right? Like riding in the rain can be a real drag, but then you realize like, oh, like we were meant to get wet and I have like a good raincoat and I have a bag so my laptop doesn't get wet. And it's like, and oh, I got to ride in the rain. It's like some of it is just expanding your comfort zone and realizing that there are rewards to be had when you do that.
Sure. And you know, we're creative people. You can strategize and allow yourself to feel more, I imagine. And how does biking as a part of your life affect kind of your relationship with time?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I mean, a couple things come to mind. One is that with my commute, I know within like 2 minutes how long it's going to take me to get to the office, where if I were driving in Los Angeles, you're like, you know, just dependent on traffic gods. Like sometimes people just come in and they miss a meeting and they were like, oh, the 405 was a parking lot and there's nothing they can do about it. And the other thing is that I do my best thinking when I ride my bike, that I always come into the office like energized with an idea, a problem that's I've figured out a solution to. There's something about the motion of just spinning your legs that frees up your mind. And I don't, like a lot of people do listen to music or podcasts in one ear when they ride, but I like to just be fully present in what I'm doing. And so for me, it's like mental health. It's great idea generation. So I wind up like getting kind of double duty out of my time rather than just sitting behind the wheel, like having a stressful time.
That's wonderful. Just wonderful.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're speaking with Peter Flax. He's written a new book called Live to Ride, Finding Joy and Meaning on a Bicycle. Peter, I'm sort of wondering who you wrote this for. Are you writing it for the person who's already a cycle enthusiast, or the someone who's maybe getting into it, or maybe someone who just doesn't understand what the deal is with biking?
Well, hopefully all of them. But I think, you know, there's been this historic feeling in bike culture that everybody belongs to a tribe. You're like, I'm a mountain biker, or I'm a recreational racer, or I'm a commuter. And my big hope for this book is for everyone who rides to realize that they're like more connected to everybody else who rides, maybe more than they thought. And so I'd say that like people who are avid about riding or just new to it, for them to realize they're a part of something pretty big. Like those are the people I'm mostly hoping to speak to, but the photos are really awesome in the book, I think. And so I'm hopeful that a larger group of people also want to check it out.
Well, I feel like since this onset of the e-bike culture, it has really introduced so many people to biking who never would have done so otherwise, which is a really great thing. It's also a little bit of a scary thing when you see what's essentially a motorcycle, but it's just electric, cruising down the rail trail at 30 miles an hour when there are people walking and everything. And I'm curious, because you see so much of this around the whole nation, if not the world, how do you see like towns and cities dealing with this sort of thing? And what do you see as kind of a solution?
Yeah, I mean, I see mostly positives. I think you're seeing some similar things right now as self-driving cars are being introduced to the roads, that there are some like regulatory issues that need to be sorted out. Like there shouldn't be anyone riding 30 miles an hour on a trail. And right now, you can go on Amazon and buy all sorts of manner of weird e-bikes that don't comply with standards. And that sort of stuff is being sorted out, right? Like that I think 10 years from now, there'll be clear rules of like what is and isn't kosher to ride on a dirt trail. But I'd say in general, these are positives, that having done a lot of mountain biking in ski towns, for instance, the idea that riding to the top in some wilderness area is just only for the young and super fit rider isn't necessarily the smartest way to use our public spaces. And so I see people that are older, people with disabilities, suddenly getting the experience of like riding to a beautiful wild place. And that's a good thing. I think batteries of e-bikes have been an issue in some places, and that mostly comes down to some regulatory issues that need to be sorted out. But if you've ridden one, you realize they're more like riding a bike than riding a motorcycle, that they have, you're pedaling and you're just getting all of the joys of riding a bike on them.
You talk with a number of fascinating people in your book about the various reasons and ideas about why bicycle riding brings so much joy and meaning. How did you find these people?
Well, I mean, I've been in this space for a really long time. I was the editor of the biggest bike magazine in the world. So in some ways, I really...
Well, that'll do it.
I dipped into my contacts. And it was really important for me to show the diversity of bike culture. There are a lot of people of color, a lot of women, a lot of people who represent demographics that maybe have not always seemed like at the center of bike culture. Like a lot of people still think that bike culture is mostly like affluent middle-aged guys, which I guess I fit that bill, but there are
a couple of those.
Yeah, there are. But if you read the book, you'll see that there are all these people that add texture to the culture and are changing it. There's an advocate who specifically focuses on the needs of fat riders and like getting clothing and bike manufacturers to be more inclusive. There are people trying to bring bike racing to inner city Black youth. That there's all these people that are making biking more inclusive, which is really critical to the long-term success of it.
Oh, for sure. And I just love the opportunity to see how people are coming at it from different areas of, social change and wonderful reasons, the things that brought them to biking and the things they're bringing back to biking.
Yeah. There's one story in the book about these women in the 1890s that were groundbreaking bike racers. And I think a lot of people don't realize how the bike has been this tool of emancipation since it was invented. And that's still happening now, right? Like in Los Angeles, the communities that are wealthy and white have much better bike lanes than the neighborhoods that are poor and Black. And so a lot of these social issues are still being worked out in real time.
Yeah, I went to Oxford in England for a year of college, and everybody rode bikes there. That's all you do, right? And it was terrific because they had the structure there. The bike lanes were there. The motorists were aware of how to treat bicyclists and respect each other on the road. How can we help communities and just individuals be more aware of bicyclists and help them by creating the right kind of lanes?
Yeah, I meet a lot of people in Los Angeles that are pretty hostile towards riders. I think once we talk and they realize that I'm not trying to convert them to a religion, I'm just like them, and I'm trying to go somewhere, and I just want to like get home and see my kids without feeling like my life was threatened. And that so much of it is just like preaching this kind of tolerance towards people that have made different choices than you've made. And that I understand that like driving is dominant and that it's really, can be really frustrating. And a lot of times it's just like being patient and accepting of people doing something different than what you're doing.
Yeah, that's such a good point. And we all have to have that kind of tolerance and patience for people who express themselves in different ways or have different come-froms or different preferences. And yet, we talked a little bit about this before we came on air about, what cyclists could be doing better to quell that hostility among motorists. And, sometimes it comes down to there's a bike path right next to the road. but the biker is in the road. And a lot of times it's because the bike path is full of broken pavement and roots and it's not feasible. But your average motorist doesn't know that. They just think, why isn't the cyclist over in the bike path where they belong? You know, what are those problems, and how have you seen solutions to that?
I think dialogue like this is really important to it. I also drive a fair amount, and so I'm always like aware that no matter what mode of transport people have, like a certain percentage of people are naughty, right? Like people drive way too fast on the highway and they talk on their phones even though it's illegal, and they change lanes without using their blinkers. And then in that same vein, a certain percentage of people who ride make choices that aren't great. But a lot of times it really does come down to, as you were saying, that people in who are behind the wheel just don't understand the experience of riding, that there is so much chaos. Like when I ride in Los Angeles, I'm in an environment that is not built or sympathetic to me. And so if I go take a lane and block a vehicle, I'm not doing it to make somebody's life difficult. I'm doing it because that's what is going to keep me safe. And that almost always I'm doing something that's legal. And it really comes down to just being patient, trying to be empathy is the solution to so many problems in our culture. And that, I understand just how confusing it can be to be behind the wheel and someone's in front of you and they seem like they're being unpredictable to you. But like when you're on a bike, you're aware that like if you screw up, you could die, right? Yeah. And so it's like I don't know many riders that don't take that part seriously. That it's not like anybody's out there with a goofy death wish. They're trying to get where they're going and try and be safe. And so if people, like they do in Europe, just go like, all right, like there must be a reason, I'm just going to be a little bit more patient. But it's I think it's going to take decades, unfortunately. Like I just because of how much I ride and how LA is, I have like the weirdest interactions every week. Like I get threatened all the time. And I'm hopeful that when my kids are my age, that they wouldn't have to worry about that kind of culture.
Yeah. I'm wondering, when you have these face-offs, these verbal face-offs with people, or, you know, they're the big diesel trucks that come by and blow their big puff of diesel right into your face purposely. And, you know, when you have the conversations and you do just try to encourage empathy and understanding, you know, are you changing people's minds about it or not?
I think it depends. I think when I was younger, I used to like want to argue with people, and partially just because when you get threatened on a bike, it's really scary, right? Like, I have a couple of times been hit in the last 40 years of riding, and it really sucks. But now, if I do talk to people, I try and find a window to get some common ground. I often will pull up my phone and I have like photos of my wife and my kids. And just like, you know, it's easy to like other a rider and be like, oh, there's some person wearing like spandex who thinks like they own the road. And I'm like, you know, I drive every day also, and I'm just going to my job, probably like you're going to your job, and that like, I'm sorry if you felt like I shouldn't be there, but I'm actually legally entitled to the space I was taking up, and you kind of scared the crap out of me. And that if people don't feel threatened, they're much more likely to like receive that input. But it is a crapshoot. Like there are times where I'm like 20 seconds into an action and I'm just like, have a good day. We're not going to get anywhere. And there's no point forcing the issue.
Yeah, to try to see each other as human beings, not just cars versus bicycle or Anything.
Yeah.
Well, I love the idea of solitary riding for fitness and contemplation, but in this town, I have to admit, it can be really intimidating. You know, things like if I got a flat or if I got injured or got lost, these freak me out a little bit. What suggestions would you give to a brand new rider, say me, to help them discover the love of bike riding?
I think that part of it is embracing like a little bit of the uncertainty that you know, that you like, I get it. Like a lot, like Peloton is also huge right now, where people like would rather just be in their living room or their garage, but there's something magical about like going out and facing some of those challenges and coming home and having a positive experience. The tire technology has really changed in the last 10 years, where you get a lot less flats than you used to do. You know, everyone's got a phone with mapping software on it, so it's harder to get lost than it used to be. But part of it is like, you know, you're going to go out and you're going to get rained on, or you're going to get lost for a few minutes, and then magically you wind up back home. And you're like, oh, I had this like 60-minute adventure, and that was actually cool, right? And again, it may not be for you.
Yeah.
I think the world will be a way better place if like 10% more people ride, and everybody's got to figure out whether it's like fits into their life or not.
I love the way you said that, just to kind of reframe it more as, you know, it's part of the experience, the uncontrollable possibilities out there. When you come home, it probably does add to your sense of accomplishment and feeling good. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
My husband's a really big biker. I feel like Strava is a part of our family. And he gets so much out of it for fitness, for mental health. He gets great ideas, like you said. And I know that it would be really fun to do some things together, but I'm working on it.
Yeah. My wife doesn't want to ride with me at all. So I like when I got married a million years ago, I thought we were going to be activity buddies. But, you know, I think now I realize, you know, everyone's got to find their own path. And that I know a lot of couples where the two people do totally different kinds of riding. Right. Like I love riding to the coffee shop and sitting outside and drinking an espresso. And that's like legit cycling, too.
Yeah, I the problem in Park City is we've got some really big hills. So sometimes you've got to commit if you're going to the coffee shop, because that trip home is going to be
right.
Really challenging.
Well, I guess the positive is that you get to eat like seconds or thirds at dinner, and like you've taken care of that.
Exactly.
There you go. And Peter, you know, cyclists quite often are not, well, not, I don't want to, you know, throw guilt on anyone or blame, but there are some things that cyclists need to do to sort of manage better in this world, you know, not riding three abreast and, you know, those kinds of things. What are those things that you want to say to avid cyclists so that the rest of the world sort of accepts cycling in a bigger way, in a bigger embrace?
Yeah, I'll say two things on that. The first is that like we talked about with drivers, that like I get on the highway and see all sorts of horrible driving. And as a driver, nobody asks me to be like to speak for or be responsible for the acts of all these horrible drivers. And I think that as a rider, you can often just feel like somebody went to Home Depot and they saw like a rider do something stupid, and it's like on us to like make up for them, which is like never gonna really work. But I would say the most important thing is that the people walking have the right of way, and that if I were like to the number one thing is to like be more empathetic to people walking. Like a lot of times when you're riding, there's just a lot of moments where I see riders like cut off people who are trying to cross the street, and just to like the same thing that we're asking for drivers for them. And yeah, I mean, like you don't run red lights, you don't ride three or four abreast, you know, you just the same things we're asking people to just, you know, be aware of the circumstances you're in. You're part of this like big puzzle of people trying to get around.
Well, the book is Live to Ride, Finding Joy and Meaning on a Bicycle. It's an illustrated guide. It's written for every type of cyclist, mountain bikers, tourers, triathletes, beach cruisers, bike packers.
Beginners.
Even vintage bike collectors. Peter Flax is our guest. Peter, thanks a lot for this. This is great. And, you know, we'll see more people on their bikes.
That's great. I enjoyed the spirited conversation.
All right.
You're inspiring us. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Have a great day.